Thanks, Allie.
Okay, great. Thank you. Thank you, Allie. Thank you, Dan. So, Marianne, if you'd give us an update on the work that you're doing.
Sure, happy to. I'm going to go ahead and share my screen, if that's all right. And I'm going to pull up the agenda for the workshop. As I think we mentioned at the last meeting last month, we had up until now been seriously considering an in-person workshop in Connecticut in the Hartford area at the MDC Training Center, scheduled for March 17th. We moved the date to March 17th. But as the pandemic progresses, it seems pretty clear that it's not likely to take place as an in-person workshop, and we might as well start planning for a virtual workshop. So our little rates workshop planning group, thank you, Virginia and Dave and Steve Rupar and Alicia, we decided at the meeting that we had that we would go ahead and script out what it might look like if we proposed it as a virtual workshop. I also checked with Jack and with Lori about whether or not, since they are both speaking on the earlier date, the March 16th date, if they were available, and both responded and said they would be available. So it looks like we can still go forward with it, doing it in two pieces. March 16th and 17th, we will do 3 hours beginning at 9 in the morning on those 2 days. We would do it virtually through our GoToWebinar program. So we would run it through the Alliance for Water Efficiency. But we would have this workshop, of course, co-sponsored by a number of organizations. Right now, there are no logos on this draft agenda, but there will be when it's issued officially. So to just walk through what we're considering, we took the day and divided it into two pieces. And this is what the first day looks like. There would be a little bit of webinar logistics that I would need to announce, but Jack will do an opening welcome. And then Lori will do a presentation for about 30 minutes on setting the stage. So that all is the same from before. Then I would do my opening presentation on what all the resources are that we provide in the Financing Sustainable Water Program, and also what the issues are that face water utility finance officers and boards in trying to figure out what conservation-oriented rates could look like and still be revenue stable. So that's kind of an opening presentation on what that all looks like. Then we would take a 10-minute break. I've seen a number of virtual workshops do that, and it seems to work fine. People come back. And then at 10:45, Bill Christensen of our staff would demonstrate the rate model. He would actually walk through and show you how the rate model works. And there will be, you know, a simple example in the rate model, but basically he would describe what the rate model does and why it would be useful for water utilities to use. Then we would have a question and answer session for 15 minutes and then adjourn at noon. So it's a 3 hour on the first day. On the second day, Jack would open us up again. I wouldn't bother with the webinar logistics because by that time I think everybody would have figured it all out. And then we will launch right into Jan Beecher's presentation, where she's going to talk about revenue adjustment mechanisms and options for what that might look like in the public utility space. And then we'll have a panel, and the panel will be water supplier and commissioner perspectives, how to get to yes on the issue of adopting water efficiency-oriented rates. I would moderate that panel. Jack is willing to be on it. We will also have probably the finance officer from the Regional Water Authority because they are one of the rate model case studies. We also will have likely one of the selectmen from the town of Portland because Portland now has agreed to be our municipal case study for the rate model. And then we'll have an additional panelist. We've been kicking around a number of names, and one that seems to surface to the top a lot is State Senator Paul Formica from East Lyme. As a former first selectman, he was involved in a lot of rate issues in East Lyme, so we're thinking of asking him. And so that would be that panel. It would go for about 45 minutes, and it would be, we would do, sort of a Hollywood Squares type thing where everybody can see everybody, but basically I will lead them through a discussion with a series of questions, and we'll go from there. Then after the panel, we will have a presentation on the two rate model case studies, Regional Water Authority and the Town of Portland. And Virginia asked a good question earlier this week. Why wouldn't we flip it? Why wouldn't we do the rate model case studies first and then do the panel and finish with the panel? We could do that. The only reason we've done it this way in the past is when we've had an in-person workshop, that's at the end of the day. And some people don't necessarily want to hang around and look at a case study of some other utility that's not like them. And so sometimes they leave. But in this particular case, since we're dividing it into two pieces, you know, we could flip them. So I'm looking for your input on whether or not you'd like to do that. Certainly the representatives from RWA in the Town of Portland would be briefed and filled in on what their model says and would be able to talk about it during the panel anyway, but interested to see what you all think of that. Then we would have Q&A and future steps. In the future steps, we would talk about how to provide some technical assistance to Connecticut water utilities that might want some additional help, and then we would adjourn at noon. So that's the proposed virtual workshop agenda if we were to go on a virtual basis. And then, you know, Tom, we would release the MDC Training Center, you know, for and thank you for having reserved it for us. But it looks like if we do this in our virtual, then that will be the substitute workshop. So we're interested in everybody's views on this.
And that starts with some high-level things of is the group in agreement that we maybe should just assume it's going to be virtual, or are there people who are gamblers who think maybe it should be in person? And then the other question is, would we want to, if possible, and this would certainly be up to the Alliance's schedule, to have it earlier if it were possible and the rates models were completed? So that would be another topic of consideration for the group.
Yeah, probably the earliest we could move it to, though, would be February, because now we've got two case studies to do. So we could move it to maybe late January or February. That would be the soonest we could move it. It would still be 2021.
And that we identified that there's a meeting, was it of the Connecticut section or the CWWA that's in February, and we wouldn't want to conflict with that or load up the same week with that. Do anybody recall what date that is? Steve, are you on the line?
Yeah, that's annual AdCave conference, and I believe it's February 23rd this year.
Yeah.
So although that's probably also going to be virtual and may stretch over a few days.
Mm-hmm. So if we moved it to February, we should do early in the month so we don't conflict with that.
Right. So thoughts on that, on either of those two subjects?
Virginia, I think you're right. I think I would love for it to be in person, but I don't see that happening. So I think you're right to switch over to a virtual workshop. I think we should just make that decision, you know, sooner rather than later. And it looks like, to me, like, you know, it's going to have to be virtual. And I don't see any real benefit in trying to rush and get it in early February. I think we've already got this on the schedule and it works for Jack and Lori. I'd say let's just keep it where it is. And do it virtual.
The one comment that came up several months ago when we were picking a date for this is that there was some discussion of having it, if it were a little bit earlier than if there was anything that we wanted to get on this legislative calendar, it might still be possible. And then at the time, my recollection is that there was a counter argument that it's not going to happen this legislature anyway, and so let's not worry about it. And I know, Alicia, you had some thoughts about that earlier. Do you want to make any comments, or are you okay with leaving it in March?
I think it would be difficult to change the timing at this point.
Okay.
But, you know, I wouldn't necessarily say that, you know, anything that it would be too late if it were in February. You know, it may give it may inform some conversations depending on what's on the legislative agenda.
So agency folks, do you have any thoughts about this? Because any legislative things would presumably go through one of your agencies.
Okay, this is Bruce. I was just going to say that the timing really isn't suitable for 2021 legislation. If it's something where the underlying work can only be completed by early February at best, and that's rushing it, there really isn't enough time, even in a normal year, to try to do anything meaningful at the legislative session. So doing it in March is a good time for then creating, say, a work group to draft legislation that could be in a legislative proposal for the following session, perhaps. You know, agencies typically are getting their legislative proposals in during, say, September. So that would be a more appropriate time frame.
I agree.
If I could add something to that, what Bruce just said, Jan Beecher is going to be presenting several different options. So not just one. She's going to be suggesting a number of different strategies. So a work group could really sift through what they would prefer in terms of moving forward. So it sounds like a good plan.
Gail, you had a comment?
Yes, I agree with Bruce, and I think we also said something to the same effect at the last meeting, that we really wouldn't have enough time regardless of whether it was February or March, and I think that it will give us plenty of time to craft something that would really have a high chance of success for the following year's session.
Okay, so what I'm hearing generally from everybody is that we should leave it on in March, presumably on the 16th and 17th, and the earliest we can get that those dates out to possible panelists and also possible attendees, the better, so that they can block it out on their calendars. And I do want to say to the group, just as a reminder, because I'm hoping that all of you or each of you talks this up in your own respective environments, is that what we're really hoping to do is get decision makers involved, not just the working folks at various water companies, but the people who are making the decisions, whether it be municipal officials for municipal systems or whether it be financial people, management level people in the various water companies. That's really our audience here. And yes, we're going to have a lot of working folks, not to say that those people don't work, but of, you know, working stiffs, whatever you want to call them, are going to be interested in attending, and that's wonderful, and they are more than welcome. But our true audience are the decision makers. So do please talk that up. We do probably should check with our panelists and make sure that they are available at least on the 17th, if hopefully both days.
The 17th was the day we originally were going to do it in person. So right now, the panelists, the one that we actually talked to, the Regional Water Authority representative, she had asked that we move it from the 18th to the 17th. So she knows it's going to be the 17th. And, of course, we haven't invited yet the Town of Portland or the additional panelists, so we'll just need to confirm that both of those are available that day. And then once we have the name identified for the additional panelists, then I think we should also add the logos for any organization that wants to co-sponsor, you know, not in terms of any funding, but just in terms of support, lending their mailing lists, et cetera. And then we can start distributing the agenda. We can, you know, PDF it and start sending it around. Because if it all looks good to you, we'll get everybody confirmed. And you know, Dave suggested that we might want to wait till after the election to approach State Senator Formica, so we can certainly do that. But I would think that by mid-November, we should be finalized with the agenda, and we should start to distribute it. Just get it out to all the mailing lists. There won't be any charge for the workshop, so it'll just be free registration. We'll handle registration at the Alliance for Water Efficiency. We'll do it through Eventbrite. So anyone who wants to register will click a link, and then they'll register, and they'll receive all the information from us. We also have we had planned to do a packet of materials, hard copy materials, which we still can do. We can mail those out, although we can send them all electronically as well. But our experience is that when you give the rate handbook to people in hard copy form, they actually read it, whereas it's a big PDF to read electronically. So I would still suggest that we send out the materials to all the panelists, and I put it in the budget so that we can make sure we do that.
We might want to say that we would be sending the hard copy materials to anybody that's registered before a given date.
Right.
And so obviously we wouldn't want it spent the money to send it and have it come in 2 days later. And also maybe that would be a little bit of pressure for people to register early.
Yeah.
So I guess we don't really have any issue with numbers if it's all virtual. So
no, and I think the material can come afterwards because we'll talk about it at the workshop, and then when they get it, they'll see it. So even if we have late registrants, they get it afterwards, I think it'll still be fine because my presentation goes through what all that is, so they'll know what they're getting in that packet.
Okay. Great. Any other questions about the workshop for Marianne?
Marianne, Dave here. Just to confirm, we talked about this the other day. There is no limit on the number of people who could potentially register for this. We had just talked about who could actually be active, if you will, as part of MICRA, right?
Well, I think we probably have a limit of 500 in our GoToWebinar program. But the thought that you might have 500 people is kind of a staggering thought. I thought we thought we would be lucky if we got 100. So I think given that it's virtual, we will have more people. I expect we could have, maybe 130, 140 folks, but we can see. But we can accommodate up to 500 on a virtual platform that we have.
Excellent.
And at this point, you have what you need as far as contacts within regional and Portland to be able to get the information to assemble your case study?
Yes. We have started discussions with Regional Water Authority. We are about to set up meetings with the Town of Portland since they just volunteered last week. So I'll be working with Dave Kuzminski to set that up. And we'll have at least one of the selectmen from the Town of Portland. That's what he suggested. And so we'll vet with our little rates task force. We'll vet the names and make sure you're comfortable with it before we finalize anything. So I will get the names. And for the Regional Water Authority, I thought it would probably be their chief financial officer, but we're going to confirm that. We had to move the date because RWA is a board meeting that day. So everybody would have been tied up with their board meeting. So we had to move it anyway. But the 17th is a good day for them. So that's what they mentioned.
Good. Excellent. Thank you. And as you all recall, not only has the Alliance for Water Efficiency has been working on this, but they've also been working on some of the other priorities that we helped identify as their contract, including looking at legislation and regulations about a number of topics. And we started with a focus on indoor water fixtures. And so you have, in several emails over the past couple of days, gotten two versions of, or two different approaches of how to handle that. Most recently, I guess it was yesterday, I sent out something that Marianne had created looking at the standards, the efficiency standards. And prior to that, I had sent out something that Dave Radka had done, actually making proposed changes to the legislation. One of the things that Dave had proposed was that we, in the body of the whatever text we use, that we reference the water sense or low flow fixtures rather than having a specific volumetric amount, so that as over time, if the water sense fixtures got more and more conserving water, we wouldn't have to be redoing it and changing those numbers. The version that Marianne was working on did include the numbers in addition to referencing the water sense. So that's one of the things that we should be discussing as part of this. But Marianne and Dave, why don't you each sort of propose your philosophies in what you did, and then we can have a discussion about it.
We don't necessarily have dueling philosophies. although I am curious, Marianne, since you just sent yours out very, very recently, and we haven't had a chance to connect. any reason why your approach was targeting revisions to the regulations instead of the statute?
These are changes to the statute. These are changes to 21A-86A.
But I just checked it very quickly today. That's the regulation. The number is the same, but it's the regulation as opposed to the statute.
I see.
Follow the statute and our Department of Consumer Protection adaptive regulations. And that's always much more difficult and challenging since they have to be the ones to initiate it. That's why I targeted the statutes.
Okay, so let me just give you some input on that. So yes, you're right. Changing into the statute is always a stronger form, but regulations can also be just as doable. And a number of the states that we looked at in our state scorecard did do it through either the building code that they had adopted or through their own regulations. The reason we suggested doing it this way is it conformed to what was already on the books. And the reason we give flow volumes and flush volumes is because sometimes you don't know what's going to happen with the water sense specification. If, for example, a water sense specification is altered in a way that you might not want to use, then you have your own flow standard in there. Let me just give you a simple example. It's not in this particular draft, but pre-rinse spray valves also have often their own state standard. And if you had listed that to be what the WaterSense standard was, you would have found that WaterSense canceled their pre-rinse spray valve specification several years ago when it was taken over by Energy Star. So we just thought it would be good to reference both. And yes, it does mean that you have to make adjustments in the flow volumes. You could also say basically indicate that you think WaterSense should always be the prevailing flow requirement or flush volume requirement. But we thought it would be good to make the changes directly to the actual regulatory language. And so this was a suggestion that we had put together.
Could we say, and I'd have to read it more carefully, read it again more carefully, could it say, give a flow volume and mention the water sense, whichever is lower?
Yep. You could do that. Yep. That's definitely an approach. And Dave's approach was patterned after what Colorado had done. And
correct.
Every state seems to do it a little differently. And before we go too far down the road, I really strongly suggest we consult someone in the legislative commissioner's office to find out because they usually have very strong opinions about how they want state statute or state regulations to read. So we might want to consult with them and see what recommendations they might have, and also figure out who might be the sponsor of it, if it's a statute, or what agency would be promulgating it as a regulation. But just touch base with those folks to make sure what we're drafting is going to be consistent with what those folks are wanting.
Yeah, I guess what I envisioned was that we the implementation work group would agree on an approach as a starting point, not necessarily being the ending language, and proffer it to the Water Planning Council and say, here, based on our conversation with AWE, your review of other states, we feel this would be prudent legislation to get behind, and let the Water Planning Council, the agencies, take it from there and decide how they want to approach it. And at the end of the day, this is all, regardless of whether we go after the statutes or the regulations, it's the Department of Consumer Protection that has to be supportive of this.
Yeah, right. And regulations, as you know, are easier to change than statutes. So a regulatory approach is not a bad approach.
Actually not in Connecticut.
Yeah, that's right. It's much, much more difficult to get regs. Can take such a long time.
Okay.
They have to go through regs review committee.
Exactly. The dreaded regs review committee, correct.
And to add to that, if you make the change in the statutes and the regulations are different, you can get a lot of conflict and this thing we went through, I forget how many years, a decade maybe more, actually much more than a decade, to redo some regulations recently. And during the period where both apply, you just end up confusing everyone. And that's why if it's going to be done, it first has to be in the statute, because you can't, the statute has to go first to give you justification to redo the regulations. And then you have to go through the regulatory process. Depending on pushback, that can take forever. Mm-hmm. And because of that pushback, the likely pushback, I think the approach of not specifying gallons, but just specifying water cents, is going to be something that goes down much more easily. Okay. Because that would highlight that Connecticut isn't trying to be a pioneer, that Connecticut is going along with what would be the general prevailing water conservation standard for the country. And I think that's a much more doable approach.
Okay.
Thanks, Bruce. Yeah, if folks go and look, if you haven't looked at the...
Yeah, stop sharing my screen so Virginia can pull up your version.
That were aligned after, in this case again, as Marianne mentioned, Colorado. It just seemed like their approach was the... To what Bruce was sort of alluding to, it's probably the simplest, easiest, less controversial way to make attendant revisions in our existing statute that doesn't call out numbers or do anything like that. It just says, hey, we're going to get on this, you know, align with this water sense train. And it's nothing new or fancy or controversial. It's just, it's there and we should align with it.
I've got the wrong screen shared here.
On the right hand side is Dave's.
On the right hand side.
You're seeing this. I'm not seeing this on my Zoom call, but if you're seeing the two of them, that's good. Okay.
Yeah. It's on the right hand side, Virginia, and you have to read it once or twice to see what Colorado was doing, because their approach, again, which I mimicked, was that they identify two things, water sense fixture and a low efficiency fixture. And then they simply go on to say, in their case, this was being first enacted, saying at this point in time, you can't install or replace a low efficiency fixture. They never really explicitly say the only thing you can install is a water sense fixture. They take that sort of, you know, different approach, a circuitous approach. Say you can't, after a date, which I just picked 2022, at that point, you couldn't in Connecticut sell anything that was a low efficiency plumbing fixture. By extension, it has to be a water sense fixture at that point in time.
So the only issue that I see with this, Colorado is the only state that does this, is low efficiency typically is something that is not in the Energy Policy Act standard. So a low efficiency toilet, for example, would be a 3.5 gallon or a 5 gallon toilet. It wouldn't be a 1.6, which is what the federal standard is. And what you're proposing here is a 1.28 under water sense. So right. Low efficiency might confuse people who do understand a little bit about water conservation, because low efficiency implies, you know, the plumbing fixtures from the 80s before the federal law was passed. So that was the reason we...
A different term? I mean, we can make up any...
We can make up another term. I think that was the reason that Bill decided to try and make the changes to the regulatory language, because he thought the low efficiency term might be confusing to people. It seems to work in Colorado, but again, they're the only state that did it this way.
So thoughts from other folks. This is a little getting into the weeds, but anybody who has a thought or a concern or a suggestion that they want to toss out or toss back to Marianne and Dave and the smaller group is primarily looking at the workshop, but to haggle about. So thoughts from anybody.
Well, this is Bruce again, and I think what we're discussing right now is exactly the kind of thing that the group should convey to the Planning Council instead of, say, eliminating an option right now. There are two good options and a number of comments regarding why one might be better than the other, and take that to the planning, well, to the advisory group or planning council, I forget the protocol here, and take it to the level where they have to think about it. The agencies can get their commissioners, council people involved and talk about statute and regulation approval processes and let them decide. I think there's been a great discussion here about the various pros and cons.
Thank you, Bruce.
If I could build off of what Bruce added, I was lucky in 2018 to serve as the legislative liaison for DPH, and I see both paths here that are written as definitely feasible. I tend to lean towards the way we use a definition, because definitions are easier to track down and cite, such as like low efficiency. But I agree with Bruce in the sense that I do think the Water Planning Council might want to consider seeing both versions, because they could bring it back to their respective departments and review it. I know we've mentioned a little bit already about how this is going to involve DCP, and just in my final experience when I was doing legislative work, typically the governor's office does not want any agencies in disagreement or not aligning in agreement, so which was not always the case with the previous governor. But in this case, you know, so anything that's going to move forward that might require any type of work or collaboration amongst multiple agencies needs to be agreed upon by all of them. So I think it's a great idea to share it with the Water Planning Council, because if it makes it through their approval and opinion, then it supports it going forward to DCP for their review.
Well, as many of you were attending the Water Planning Council meeting last week, and they had talked about involving DCP not only in this, but also in the sharing the groundwater white paper with them. And I think it would be a good idea to get them involved in our discussions before we are making recommendations or sending multiple options to the Water Planning Council, just so that we can say that, or they can say that they're already involved, and help prepare the management level folks for weighing in on a final recommendation.
Virginia, David, I understand what you're saying, but I think in this case, given the amount of feedback we've been getting from Mike's group and others, how difficult it is to engage with DCP, that we would be ill-served by waiting on them. I think the approach that Bruce and Dan were talking about is just giving it to the Water Planning Council. If we give them both and we say, here comes with our recommendation that you take a serious look at one of these two approaches, or a hybrid, or whatever you want, and let them figure out how to move forward with engage with DCP. I think that's really how we have to go at this point.
This is Steve Rupar. I just have one. It's not related to process or which of these options is best, but just again, and I've said this before, just for information for people, that there are looming issues with the drop in demands by promoting ultra efficient appliances and fixtures. Demands are dropping. Water utility systems were built around much higher demands and much higher demand projections, and there are water quality concerns today with disinfection byproducts and water age, and also pump efficiency concerns. So it's just want people to be aware, and we probably should, make the Water Planning Council aware at some point, if they're not already, that, this is not cost-free, that as demands continue to drop, water utilities are going to be faced more pressure to upgrade their underground piping, upgrade pumps, and treatment systems. So it's not, this isn't just, win-win. And I'm not opposed to this at all. I just think that the Water Planning Council should be made aware that that is something to keep an eye on.
Mary Ann, is any of that part of the discussion in your rates discussion? Because clearly those are water conservation rates, and these same issues would surface as we save water through whatever mechanism.
Yeah, Steve is right. The water aging issue has gotten on everybody's radar screen in the past several years, and it's caused a number of utilities to step up their water flushing, their system water flushing, to make sure that the chlorine residual is being pulled through to the customer meter. Because what we were finding in the utility industry is that customers were no longer getting chlorinated water because the water had been sitting in the pipes so long and the chlorine residual had been compromised. So that's created some real turmoil within the industry, and when you flush a lot of water, of course, you're wasting the water that you were supposedly saving. So now there are strategies for capturing the flush water in tanker trucks and reinserting into the system. There are all kinds of strategies that are being looked at. But to answer your question directly, we will mention it in the rates workshop for sure. It is part of a total water system analysis for the utility. And on the wastewater side as well, as you reduce flows from these plumbing fixtures on the wastewater side, it does alter slightly how you treat the decreased amount of water and the increased amount of solids. And so those are issues that we are all dealing with. I think the bigger problem we're going to see here is that building pipe sizes are also going to be going down and changing, so codes are going to be changing, and that's going to affect also distribution main sizing, because if you're assuming you're going to be supplying customers and buildings and suddenly that water demand is less than what was expected, as Steve points out, your infrastructure may be oversized, and when it's oversized, you don't want to be doing replacement piping at that same diameter pipe. You want to be reevaluating that. So the whole thing is a big issue. I agree with Steve. It's probably something we should talk about at the Water Planning Council. But the states that have done these fixture analyses and standards changes are states that where the utilities are experiencing these issues. Many of them, of course, are in the western part of the United States, but they are definitely looking at measures to stem the tide of water aging that Steve is mentioning.
This is Bruce. To follow up on what Mary Ann and Steve were talking about, you remember Gil Bly from New Britain Water Company, who used to be an advisory group member. And I forget if he told me this in conversation or if he mentioned it during an advisory group meeting, but they were experiencing problems in New Britain because of, a largely older building stock, and a lot of the building plumbing, from within the building all the way out to the sewer line to the street were sloped at a time when they could count on a flush of water being 5 or more gallons. And they were experiencing regular problems where, say, a house's plumbing was set up where they had a toilet kind of isolated. If it did not have, I remember him saying, if it did not have a shower or a washing machine upstream of that toilet, they often had problems. And this is a thing we have to bear in mind. Unlike those rapidly growing Western states, we're talking about places where pretty much everything that's going to be built has already been built. And the plumbing, the internal plumbing, all the slopes and everything are sized for something different.
Yeah.
So that's a big issue. And then the other half of what Steve mentioned is, we could find out from the rates analysis that the last thing the Connecticut water industry needs right now is to find a new way to reduce water use even further. So these are complicated issues, and absolutely the Planning Council has to be thinking long and hard about them.
Bruce, your comment about the slope of pipes within the house, I experienced firsthand when I lived in Massachusetts, when low flow toilets were first coming out. We put them in and we had blockages because we didn't have that slope to flush things out to. In our case, it was a septic system.
Yeah, the slope calculation is what they call it, Hunter's curve. That was designed in the 40s. And it hasn't been updated, and it's being updated now. And in the updates, new buildings are going to be built with different slopes and a whole different calculation, but that doesn't help those buildings that are already there.
So when I asked you last week or whenever, Marianne, about whether you had the data to show that indoor fixtures were a substantial use of water, was that based on current uses? As Steve said, the use has been declining over decades. So what time stamp did that analysis have?
So there was an analysis done. The Water Research Foundation commissioned a big study of residential end uses in 1999. And they examined, I think it was 1,300 homes across the U.S. and Canada, and good representation from the East Coast as well. And then that study was repeated in 2016. And what we found was that the average home indoor water use went from 62 gallons per person per day down to 58. And those who had put in WaterSense fixtures, their water use was down to 36. So there is data that shows that the savings from the more strict plumbing fixture requirements do save a fair amount of water. And that's documented in the Water Research Foundation study.
And what's the penetration? What percentage of the people had the lower flow fixtures? Approximately.
I'll have to go back and look because what they did was they segregated, the figure that I gave of 36 was only those that had been WaterSense fixture oriented. I think it was probably about 20 or 30% of the households. But I have to go back and look at the 2016 data and sort that out. But I can get that answer for you.
Yeah, my basic question is, has most of the advantages already been achieved, or is there still a lot to go? That's the question I'm really asking.
So you're asking a saturation question about the state of Connecticut, and that's something that I don't know. And we can look into that to see. There's natural change out of plumbing fixtures because as people remodel their bathrooms and they go to Home Depot and Lowe's and their plumbing suppliers, they're only getting fixtures that are complying with the 1992 federal law. So there is natural turnover. Sometimes it's around 4%, between 3 and 4%. So we assume that there has been turnover within Connecticut. How much that is, usually that you do a saturation study to figure out what the percentage is of those who have the old toilets versus the new ones. And you and I have had a conversation about shower heads. They get changed out on a regular basis. So that's something that we would need to do a little bit of work on, and you might want to commission a deeper dive into that. We can tell some from the census information because the census tract information has some of this data, but we can take a look at that for you.
Okay.
At this point, I can't answer the question because I don't know specifically, since Connecticut's not looked at this issue and not really done a lot of fixture retrofit programs. So it would be whatever the natural replacement has been within households in Connecticut.
Okay. Well, thank you all for your comments. I think this has been a very robust discussion, and we should move along to the topical subgroup for.
Okay.
Any dire questions that you want to ask before we move on? Anybody? Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
So it's raining, and as of, the day before yesterday, we were in pretty significant drought, and the drought group, both at the state interagency group and our drought group, was very concerned. The inch that I've gotten at my house isn't going to solve everybody's problems, but what are the thoughts from the drought group? Steve, would you like to bring us up to date?
Sure. On the progress of our work group, we are now meeting every 2 weeks, and we are through the review of the 2016-17 drought and have moved into the analysis and report writing stage. What we're doing is we've independently, each member has come up with the top 10 recommendations and a supporting finding based on our work to date. And we've gone through a couple meetings and a process using SurveyMonkey to try to independently also look at those and find out which are consensus recommendations that everybody agrees with and findings, or those that are more controversial, or those that not very few people agree with. And to refresh everyone's memory, we had four charges that we're addressing. So we've also mapped our recommendations and findings to those four charges to make sure we have enough material to support our report on each of those four charges. We're going to be dividing up into, I'm not going to use the word subcommittee, but you know, one or two people task groups that are going to each take one of the charges, and you know, work on developing the report using the consensus findings from our discussion and recommendations as a basis for writing that section. We were also talked about our overall schedule. We had said November we would be finished. We feel we're going to need more time. We lost some time and efficiency due to COVID. So we're looking for another month. We'll get the draft report together by December, if that schedule works for everybody. Regarding the current drought, Bruce is on this call, but I would say we have several of our members are part of the current interagency drought work group, and many of the things we've been talking about for improvements seem to have been implemented. The interagency drought work group is definitely meeting more frequently than they did in 2016-17. Membership is much more consistent. Participation is consistent. The documentation of what they're looking at and the decisions they're reaching is much improved. And they also seem to be looking harder at situation in regions versus just the whole state as a whole. So we're very encouraged by what we're seeing from the interagency drought work group. And I don't know, Bruce, if you have anything else to add to that.
Nothing really. Just speaking for myself, it's awfully premature to say that the rain we're seeing is making a lot of difference, because I know from digging in the soil at my own house just a few days after we got about an inch and a quarter a week or so ago, there was very little sign of it in the ground, although everything looked green. And that regional thing is a real beast, because eastern Connecticut has managed to miss a lot of the rain. I just checked after Virginia said how much rain had fallen in this area, and extreme southeast area, measuring at Westerly and Norwich area, they might be under three quarters of an inch out of this. So there can be quite a variation, and this will be with us for a little while.
So Steve, Dave here. You mentioned that you were trying to map your recommendations, consensus recommendations, or otherwise, to the original four charges. As I recall, those came out of a letter from OPM, I want to say.
It's from Eric.
I think three of them came from the state water plan, and one of them came from the cover letter that went with the drought plan.
Okay.
So it's a mixture of the two.
I'm curious, are there other things that you are developing or seeing as far as potential recommendations that don't align well with that, or are you able to fit everything in you feel is in? I guess I want to make sure anything you've come across and discussed as a group that you feel is important enough gets put into whatever you're developing as far as a recommendation paper.
Well, we're fairly lucky in that one of our charges is kind of open-ended. And we're, you know, frankly, a lot of the stuff is being dumped into that final charge, which was would the current drought plan have been effective in the 2016-17 drought? And a lot of our findings and recommendations seem to be mapped to that one. In other words, they're dealing with improvements to process.
Yep, excellent.
Steve and Bruce, forgive my ignorance on this question, but I'm just curious how I read about the different categories for the, you know, for the Connecticut, you know, what we're doing here as far as like moderate drought, incipient drought, that sort of thing. So right now, Hartford Town, Windham counties are considered in moderate drought. But if you look at the United States Drought Monitor, they call it extreme drought. And I was reading on the website that we use the Connecticut Drought Monitor as one of the criteria to determine our categories. But it, you know, it was just confusing when I was trying to explain this to my students, because we were talking about this in my class. And I'm just curious, either of your thoughts on that.
As Virginia will remember from back when we were trying to update the drought plan, we went through lots and lots of discussion on what words to use, or even whether to use words, and whether to have code yellow, code orange, code red, code extra red, or whatever, because water companies have their own drought plans that are based on their own individual criteria. We have our criteria, the U.S. Drought Monitor has its criteria, and so at any point in time, it's entirely plausible for someone to have, you know, a person at their home, they're under one name from Drought Monitor, another name from the state plan, and another name from their local water company plan. Personally, I think I would rather us go to code green, code yellow, code whatever, and just avoid the conflict. But it's inherent. And the words that they use for the U.S. Drought Monitor, I feel, are a little too harsh. If you look at the kind of time frames, so they have thought it through. They tend to be a bit more analytic with it. And so their initial level, which would be the D1, I think they look at that as being something you should expect to experience every third year, the next one every fifth, every tenth. I think those are the ones. And then I forget beyond that. I know the top one is every 50th year, which, of course, for us would be like going back not even all the way to the 1960s drought. And I think when it's a 1 in 50 kind of event, yes, that's extreme or severe or whatever. When it's maybe a 1 in 5 event, I don't think of extreme or what those kind of words for those shorter kind of time frames. But it's a question of semantics, and we have to apologize for it, because it's just the nature of what happens based on our decision to use those words.
Just picking up on that, I threw a question to the topical group along those lines, is there's been a lot of complaints over the past several years about having conflicting designations from the water companies versus the state. And now that the National Drought Monitor is in the public lexicon, it's used by the media all the time, there's a possibility, as Bruce just said, of a third designation that's conflicting. And a thought that I had was whether that somebody should do a study comparing the National Drought Monitor stages to what the state stages were at that same time. And if there was a fairly consistent relationship between the two, is just to convert the entire drought plan to be based on the National Drought Monitor, and the drought plan would then be focused on what needed to happen at each of those stages, both in terms of communication and in terms of mandated cutbacks at whatever level, and have it just be back to having two potentially conflicting designations rather than having three. But as I said, that would all be predicated on there being a consistent relationship. If the Drought Monitor is saying D4 and we're saying level 3 and that relationship holds, well, then let's just drop one of them out and simplify it in that way. And I don't know if the group had a chance to discuss that, but that was just something that I threw out to them.
We did discuss that, Virginia. I would say there was not consensus around that at all. Some of the concerns had to do with, you know, right now the current Connecticut drought plan is looking at, I don't know the number off the top of my head, 8 to 10 indicators. And if anything, we don't feel like there is enough groundwater and stream flow monitoring points in the state to arrive at some of the decisions we're reaching. The plan also allows for professional judgment, which is key, I think, and it allows for flexibility. And I think there was concern from those who don't like your suggestion that, you know, just cutting back to one indicator. Besides, you know, the benefit is potentially the labeling. The drawback is not having enough indicators and being forced to do something by, you know, by a large overseeing body that may not have the finite detail that we have in Connecticut.
Bruce, do you know what is included in the National Drought Monitor and whether they are using some kind of professional judgment or are they just putting it into an algorithm with the data that they have?
No, it's largely a lot of the data they look at come out of algorithms as far as, you know, various measures, specific precipitation index and so on. But they actually have a remarkable level of local information coming to them because, say, someone from the National Weather Service in Boston will get back to them. We also have the Northeastern Drought Early Warning System that will chime in, and they will include things like media coverage and so on. So I find no fault with the way they do it. I can tell you, however, that the National Drought Monitor people supposedly do not like states using their declarations for something like local drought declarations. I know they have issues with with the federal government using their classifications for drought relief payment decisions, because that puts a lot of dollars on their determinations that they feel don't belong there. And they really feel that rather than have their determinations be steering what we do, what we do ought to help them steer their determinations. They would like to get more local feedback than they're already getting.
And so then it's unfortunate that the media has picked it up and uses it exclusively.
Well, you know, bear in mind that every single week they come up with a very rigorously updated map and specific data. I would use it too if I were in the media. And we just have to be prepared that there will be some differences and some conflicts. We feel that system kind of overemphasizes the more agricultural drought factors. And so it can be screaming fast, going from essentially no drought up to very severe levels with just a few weeks of drying, where you would never see an impact on, say, a water company or possibly even a stream in that time frame. But given that a large part of the country is non-irrigation agriculture, it really matters. And so they sometimes get way ahead of us. And granted, our group wasn't meeting often enough, but we've had times where they've gone all the way up to severe and back down before we could even have a meeting. So they're a very responsive thing.
Well, thank you all for the information. It's very useful for me and very educational for me to learn a little more about how this works.
Okay. Well, thank you, Steve. It sounds like your group is making great progress, and
Virginia, can I?
Certainly. Iris, go ahead.
So regarding the stages, so can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay. So there is the Nationals classification, there's the state classification, and then utilities have their own classification. And I read in the drought plan from 2018 that they're on purpose they're distinct and to avoid confusion, and I thought that makes more confusion. So does anybody maybe from the utility companies, is anybody familiar why they would say that this avoids confusion when in the state you have utility companies that use their drought classification that is slightly different than the state? And you don't have to answer now. It's just like one more thing for Mike for you to look into. So.
In some ways, I think it does make sense. You know, I talked about this with my students. We looked at the entire water year, for example, and we weren't that far behind. So the big reservoir systems had a pretty good supply on hand. Whereas, you know, for the growing season, for this summer, we were really far behind. So, you know, I kind of get why they might have some different metrics that they use. And, you know, so the water company doesn't want to alarm people and say, you know, we're in a severe drought when they've got plenty of water on hand. But it is confusing for people to have all these different things out there.
Okay.
If I could just add in, one of the big things I think we're going to be making recommendations on is the communication piece on this, both internally up and down between the water utilities, the municipalities that are on the front line with the interagency, you know, drought group, and also with the media, and, you know, how we need to work out this communication piece. I think that's going to be key. One of the things that I noticed, and one of the things being in, you know, southwestern Connecticut, where there was a big drought, and in the New York metro, if you will, news area, was that there wasn't a lot reported in the Connecticut media on what was happening in southwestern Connecticut from a drought perspective and whatever. So just always putting that out there that the media is going to use what they can in the absence of discussion or anything from the state. So that's one of the things that we haven't gotten into it yet so much with the drought committee, but that came up for us definitely for those who are living the 2016 drought in southwestern Connecticut, was that without information coming out from the state, you know, on even on a regional level, but not going out, then it's the media that fills the void. So it's one of the things we do need to look at, I think. So just putting that out there.
Okay. Well, thank you all. I think this has been another very important discussion. And keep up the good work, Steve and colleagues, and we'll look for a report by the end of the calendar year. So let's move along to celebrate the completion and the delivery of the white paper from the Private Wells Work Group. Thanks to Mike and his crew. We sent that to the Water Planning Council. They got it just the day before their meeting last week, so needless to say, they had not had a chance to digest it, and it will be on the agenda for their November meeting. And
I would just like to acknowledge your work on the final effort here, Virginia. So we brought it to the 99-yard line, and I was having trouble getting it that last yard. So I really, really appreciate the help responding to the comments we had and getting that finalized version ready.
Well, you're very welcome, Mike, and thanks for those thoughts. And we do want to discuss with the Water Planning Council Advisory Group perhaps a tweak in our policy. You may recall back, I think it was the July meeting, this group decided that we would respond to the comments from the advisory group members in writing, and we did get two sets of comments this time, which was doable to respond to each individually, but when David and I talked about it, we figured that we really wanted to have the advisory group comments as opposed to individuals on the advisory group comments, because if we had had 10 respondents, or even all 20 of the, or however many there are on the advisory group, it would become completely undoable to respond to all of them. And so this is something, and I sent you an email, Alicia and Josh as well, that we want to discuss at the Water Planning, at the Water Planning Council Advisory Group, whether they could take the first step in collating the comments that came in, and sort of the way Steve was talking about with his group. If there was general consensus about a particular concern, Certainly, it would be passed along to us to address, but they would do that first cut and send us a single advisory group response, which would not be just copy and paste everybody else's response, but that they do the first job of digesting it, if you will, before passing it along to the implementation work group. So it would be more work on their part, certainly, but make it a more streamlined process.
Yeah, I think if we had more responses than the two, that we would, we certainly would have compiled them and condensed them. But you also have to understand if there's any controversy there, it's our commenting and producing something from the advisory group as a whole may take a little bit longer, because once we compile it, we can bring it back and then, you know, have it voted on. but it'd be the responses we got for the private wells paper were very specific and didn't contradict one another. I'm sure there will be instances where we'll have a lot more interest in something that comes out and more comments that have to be compiled.
And just for example, and it certainly has not yet happened, well, it has not yet been proposed, but if we, the implementation work group, were dealing with eliminating registrations, we would have dozens of comments coming in on that, which would be overwhelming. But this is more of a discussion for the advisory group in terms of how to work out the details of a plan along those lines, and so we'll not spend the time on it here. But again, that is completed. It's been the first completion of one of our work groups, and so I think the process worked very well in that, and many thanks to Mike and his folks. So Mike, if you want to continue that discussion with the water quality aspects of the domestic wells, please do.
Sure. So I'll just be very brief here on this, Virginia. We had our first meeting, and we had a very lively discussion. Virginia did pop in for a bit and participate. So very, very good discussion about the draft scope we have put together. I think everybody mostly agreed that we didn't really need to make any changes to that. What we're working on now is figuring out who else needs to be invited. So we have some suggestions that came from members of our team. And so I've reached out to them to attend our next meeting and potentially ongoing meetings. So our next meeting, we have scheduled it for October 26th, and hopefully it'll be a monthly meeting going forward on that date.
So is that like the third Thursday or whatever? Is it a scheduled date or is it just a chosen date?
I think it's going to end up being the fourth Monday of the month. Hopefully every month has a fourth Monday in it here.
Okay. One question, Mike, you had sent out a recording of that meeting that you had. Is that going to be your practice, or are you going to develop notes?
I've actually been thinking about this and how to handle it. And I'm sure I can agree here that it's time consuming to take the notes and compile those and get them out. And I we've always liked to do that. But in the age of having these recordings, I question whether we need to do it. But it is nice to be able to read a bulleted list of something rather than having to listen to a full hour recording. So I'm behind on getting the notes out for that meeting, but I will have them by next week.
Now, we've been very lucky in that we've had agency folks take notes for us. I'm not in any position to commit an agency, but just, do you have any agency folks on your group?
We have our DPH folks and DEEP as well.
Okay.
And then we have our university folks and health districts. So I nobody volunteered, but I didn't twist any arms either.
Hey, throw a student into that mix, Mike, and you got it solved.
Now you're thinking. That's right.
Or an intern.
I got to delegate better.
Hey, Mike, Dave here. I tried to listen to your recording and couldn't.
Really?
It said this may take a while downloading, and it just sort of sat there for. I don't know if anyone else reported having any problems, but I I did try it twice and struggle with that.
Gave up both times.
Maybe I didn't wait long enough. But my recommendation would be, in the interest of brevity, but also to produce something, maybe you just want to make sure you're capturing who attended, the date, obviously, any decisions that you reached, and or any action items that people need to follow up on.
Yeah, that sounds good. Thanks, Dave. So I appreciate that, and I will check on that recording. I'm not sure why that happened. Other ones have been okay, but I'll double check.
It may have been on my end.
I'll make sure. Thank you.
And if it were possible, and this would somebody more technologically savvy than me should weigh in on it, if it were possible to, if there was a decision made, if you could do an approximate time stamp so that if somebody read that and said, oh my God, how'd they come to that decision, they would know to go to the first part of the recording, or the middle part of the recording, or the end part of the recording. Obviously, you're not going to be able to do it minute by minute, but give them some guideline if they wanted to follow up to understand how that decision was determined. Okay, thank you very much. The outreach and education topical subwork group. Lou, are you on the call? If you were.
Yeah, so Lou had to jump off, so he asked me to just kind of give a quick update. First, before I forget, we're going to have our next meeting will be, he had just done a quick doodle poll, and it's going to be tomorrow at 9 a.m. And we're following up on a couple of things, one being that we had done some outreach to some of the different groups, including CACIWIC. For those who are not familiar with CACIWIC, CACIWIC is the Connecticut Association of Inland, Wetland, and Conservation Commissions. And so that organization we thought was a great organization to bring the state water plan to as an outreach effort. And when we contacted them, they said, oh, we're in the process of drafting our agenda now for our annual meeting, which is either going to be November 14th or 21st. We're waiting for the confirmation on that. But we will be doing a program for them, basically giving them an overview of what the state water plan and how municipalities, particularly the land use agencies like the Conservation Commission, Inland Wetland Commission, can be involved with moving the state water plan forward. And, we could talk about things in that regard, such as, did you know that, from a drought perspective, we need to have somebody named as the liaison with your town, who your town's liaison is, to the drought plan. So those types of things. So we're going to be meeting tomorrow, really to talk to, look at what we'll talk about and bring that back to the group and have some of those discussions on how the presentation should go. And then also looking at some of the other outreach items that we discussed last time. So there's nothing really new since last time on the other items.
Okay, thank you. You had mentioned identifying two audiences. One audience would be probably at the CACIWIC annual meeting, the other audience being the general public. One of the questions that came up in another discussion that I've had in the last couple of weeks is, just sort of to put it bluntly, why should the general public care about the state water plan? As some of the recommendations from the plan are being implemented and they are asked to be doing something, and even if it were this water fixture thing, then I can see that it would be necessary to be educating them. I just wonder what the group's thoughts are in terms of as the plan itself. Why should they care?
So I think there's two things when we identified the audience. And one is, okay, there are people who need to know about the state water plan and more the details of the plan. But then the plan itself, and understand where the state water plan implementation group. So when we're looking about that outreach, that's kind of education, educating people about the plan. But then there's the education piece, if you will, about some of the things in the plan, which is about our water supply and whatever. So we're looking at how to do that general education piece about, like, okay, where do we get our water from in Connecticut? Why should we care about it? Those types of more general pieces. So, for example, we invited Sue Quincy from Connecticut DEEP, who does Project WET, which used to stand for Water Education for Teachers. Now they've kind of changed it because it's not just for teachers. It's basically just water education, you know, in general. So, but the idea is getting people to understand that, you know, water resources are used for multiple purposes, and how do we protect them and make sure that we have enough water as well as enough clean water. So there's that general piece. So we're talking about both of those. I think for what the public should know is that we have a state water plan, and I think there's a whole host of reasons. When we were trying to get the state water plan adopted, legislators are not going to adopt a state water plan or move forward when they are not educated about it. And it can't be just the legislators, it's the public that pushes legislation and pushes this agenda. And similarly, as we get into water conservation and we're talking to people about why they need to conserve water on their properties, why they need to, you know, look at lawn irrigation and some of those other topical areas, the public needs to know, because that's part of the implementation of the plan. The education and outreach isn't just that we have a plan, it's also that we've got these things in the plan, and the public needs to know the things that are going to be coming down in terms of, you know, getting the plan implemented.
Okay, thank you. Other comments, questions about the outreach and educational topical group? Okay, well, thanks, Denise. And then lastly, we have the regional and interconnections topical sub-work group. Dave, do you want to bring people up to date on that?
There's not much to update, folks. The Water Planning Council punted again, so they presumably will be taking this topic up at the November meeting.
So, yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, the, Alicia, are there things that we should be aware of with the Water Planning Council Advisory Group that overlap with the work that we're doing?
Not that I can think of at the moment.
We're not hearing you. You don't appear to be muting. Now we can hear you.
Okay.
But you're very soft.
Okay, sorry. Not that I can think of right off the top of my head.
Okay, great, thank you. And public comment. Any questions, comments, concerns?
This is Bruce. I'll pretend I'm a member of the public moment for just a moment. I wanted to toss out an idea way back near the beginning of the meeting, but the opportunity passed too quickly, and that was when discussing the additional panelist for the workshop in the spring, and the talk was about inviting Senator Formica, and it seemed to me that a better choice would be to invite someone from Office of Consumer Counsel or someone in a similar role who could talk about the consumers, because they are the ones who might be facing big rate increases or even minor rate increases. And I'm sure that the committee already considered someone in that kind of role. And I was just curious what the thought process was that didn't lead to that result.
Bruce, Dave here. So in OCC, someone like Rich Sobolewski, is a valid point, but that's also largely going to be, or would be, the entity that would be weighing in on private water utility rate cases, the exception being MDC's Dave Silverstone. They're dedicated to person, consumer advocate, I guess you'd call it. So we really didn't have that type of discussion about should we have someone with OCC. And also I think what we're looking for is to have them be part of the panel where we would be trying to get to yes, as it were, as Marianne has described that. And so we thought someone like a Paul Formica who would be also able to speak to the legislative process if things came up that that would have to go through and get legislative approval. Also, it would help balance it because he's a Republican, but he's also well-versed in water issues and has been pretty progressive in trying to get cooperation in the southeast area of the state along with their regional pipeline and things like that. So it's and he's on energy and technology as ranking member. So that's what sort of led us to him. But if he can't do it, we could certainly look to someone like a Rich Sobolewski or someone at OCC.
Okay, thanks.
That makes sense?
It does. I mean, just speaking for myself, because of Jack Butkoski being on there and his agency largely not being involved with municipal and the regional water companies either, as far as I know, I was just thinking it would be good because I assume he'll be talking about, you know, their vast experience in setting rates for water companies of all different sizes and characteristics, and that it would be a good counterpoint to some of the other discussions. And if nothing else, it looks good because, you know, the discussion will almost certainly be about how can we raise rates, and to not have a consumer advocate be part of it seems a little problematic to me. But I do trust the judgment of the people on the committee putting this together.
I think it'll be, we lost Marianne, so she can't weigh in, but one of the things that I am pleased with is since we decided to go virtual and we're presenting it that way to you all today, that I thought maybe this is going to be kind of a difficult thing to pull off and with equal weight on both days, and that we could either lose people on the second day or vice versa. But I think the way that AWE and this is sort of shaping up, there's enough of interest over the 3 hours in the first day, and I'm not sure if it's three full hours in the second, but I think it's going to be pretty balanced and pretty compelling on both days. So we're hoping that we get large participation and we get a lot of interest and people stick it out, and actually there's some good takeaways, and maybe that then forays into some actual working groups or something to delve into this with a little more detail, how we might improve some of these processes for municipalities.
Bruce, we can certainly take your concerns back to the small group that's dealing with Marianne and perhaps come up with some ideas to share with you and the rest of us.
Thank you.
Other comments from public or non-public? Okay, not hearing any. Thank you all, and I look forward to meeting again with you. Those people who are not on the group itself, if you make sure that you've identified yourself in the chat, I think most of you had, and this is a small enough group that we can see, and everybody's got a name on their black square, so we probably have captured just who's been with us, but I appreciate your participation.
So our next, the 10th or 17th, what are we on? 10th, right?
It's the 10th, yeah, the second Tuesday.
November 10th.
Right.
And there's no holiday conflicts or anything like that, right? Like a Veterans Day or something.
Veterans Day is the
Monday.
It's the next day is Veterans Day.
Okay. I'm just, while we have everybody, I'll make sure in case we had to reschedule, we're good.
I think we're good.
Okay.
Okay, great. Thanks so much, folks.
Thank you all.
Have a good one.
Bye.